So on this 27th day of March 2011, in San Diego, on a Sunday feast, we're speaking from the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, chapter 26, text 22. And we're going to chant word by word. It's auspicious to chant these mantras, these verses. It may be a little difficult, but try to follow. It's not very difficult. Svachatvam Avikaritvam Shantatvam Iti Chetasaha Vrittibir Lakshanam Proktam Yatapam Prakriti Para. Very good. Translation. After the manifestation of the Mahatattva, these features appear simultaneously. As water in its natural state, before coming in contact with earth, is clear, sweet, and unruffled, so the characteristic traits of pure consciousness are complete serenity, clarity, and freedom from distraction. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The pure status of consciousness, or Krishna consciousness, exists in the beginning. Just after creation, consciousness is not polluted. The more one becomes materially contaminated, however, the more consciousness becomes obscured. In pure consciousness, one can perceive a slight reflection of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As in clear, unagitated water, free from impurities, one can see everything clearly. So in pure consciousness, or Krishna consciousness, one can see things as they are. One can see the reflection of the Supreme Lord, and one can see his own existence as well. This state of consciousness is very pleasing, transparent, and sober. In the beginning, consciousness is pure. Om Gyanatam Randasya Gyanandana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilatam Mena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. The Sri Parampara is a disciplic succession of spiritual masters and disciples, which disciples in turn become spiritual masters. This is called the Parampara. And this knowledge comes down in that way without being distorted from all the way from Krishna down to the present day. So in this verse, in the context here, is that Lord Kapila is explaining how the universe was created. And this Mahatattva is the sum total of all the material ingredients before there's any action, before there's any differentiation. It's just like you go into a kitchen. You go into this kitchen, there's so many vegetables, so many spices, milk products, and so forth. But if there's no devotees in there, nothing's happening. The feast is not being cooked. It's just, they're just sitting and waiting. So the Mahatattva is all of the ingredients of the creation. The solid matter, the gases, the liquids, the radiant energy, even subtle energies like the mind, intelligence, these are all material. These all exist in the Mahatattva. So here, Lord Kapila is saying that in its natural state, consciousness is originally very clear and pure and calm and focused. And this is what we're going to discuss tonight. So what I'd like to do is first give an analogy or work up to the theme here. And that is the environmentalism, environmental movement and ecology and the awareness of the environment that I think all of us have grown up understanding, and it's very prominent in the news and in our own lives. So I'd like to, if you will, give a little trace, just a few minutes, the history of the environmental movement. I looked it up on Wikipedia, got a few facts, and see how that relates to our present condition and how it relates to Krishna consciousness. So environmentalism goes way back. Even in the Middle Ages, in 1239, there was a problem with burning of sea coal in England or Europe somewhere. And people would just go out on the beach and get this kind of rough coal and burn it, and then it'd be too much air pollution. And so there was the decree by the king that this can't happen anymore. And later on, in the Industrial Revolution, which started in England with these big factories, And in 1863, there was a law passed against air pollution, too much burning of coal. Now, all along, and we're just going to really trace really fast how it came to America and so forth, clearly there was an advantage to burning all this coal. There were capitalists, there were people who had money, they wanted to make more money, so they built these industries, and they didn't care what happened to the air. They just kept burning the coal, but after a while it became unbearable in London and other cities, and so certain people rose up and articulated a law and said, okay, we got to cool it. We have to, you know, at least get the coal, you know, burning far away, put in some filters like that. So this is the balance you see. There is a constantly there's some advantage for individuals for doing activities that in collective society cause a problem, and then there's some remedy that's tried. Ben Franklin, you know, Ben Franklin, 1739, there were the tanneries in Philadelphia. All this toxic waste was coming from the tanneries right in the city, and he had a movement to get them out of the city or stop it. And in the 20th century, of course, we have the famous Silent Spring. Does everyone remember what Silent Spring was? Well, Silent Spring was a book by Rachel Carson that launched the modern environmental movement in America. And Silent Spring, I never knew what it meant until fairly recently. It meant that the birds aren't singing. The spring has come, but where's all the birds singing? And what happened was that all this DDT was being put on. They came up with this weed killer, what was it, I think? Or insect killer. And they sprayed it everywhere. And the birds, they didn't, many of them died. And so there was this suddenly it was realized, well, there's a downside to this. DDT was everywhere. And so they restricted it. And they found that it was toxic to the birds and also to human beings. And, of course, today in America we have a great kind of the greenhouse gases and the global climate change, warming some places, gets colder other places. This is going on constantly, and it's not just America, all over the world, right? So there's a great movement. Well, what are we doing to our planet? It's out of balance. All of these green, just carbon dioxide itself is, if in higher quantities, can be damaging to the balance of this environment. So, and now very prominently with this tsunami and earthquake in Japan, the nuclear contaminants, you see? The general principle here is that you have a certain balance in nature. And all along here you had people like Henry David Thoreau, who went out to Walden, who was moving for a more natural way of life, closer to the land, closer to the nature. I remember in the 60s, part of the hippie movement was getting back to the land. We started these communes. You know, generally they broke down, but the feeling was it's too disturbing and too unnatural in the city, so we'll go out to the country and be more natural. And now you have this fear of the nuclear, you know, right up here. What was it, 10 miles we have San Onofre? It's built right on the sand on a big fault. Not so hopeful now, huh? So, you know, that's a little problem. You know, maybe we should shut it down. I read that it's actually supposed to be shut down next year. But, of course, the big companies who run it make money. They want to push it back to 2020. Maybe we should all get a petition and shut it down on time, you know, not take the chance. So this is now the environmental movement. This is the external environment that we all share. And we see that by the works of man, by the buildup of all this industry, there's imbalances created. There are toxins in the environment that affect all of us. And so there's an effort to try to control that, balance it out, find some other way of generating energy and getting rid of the bugs for the agriculture, whatever, so it's not so toxic, so it doesn't harm each of us. Now let's move to our own environment. That's the external environment. It's a constant struggle. Today there's still a battle. The big industries are always fighting the regulation. Right? And the people are always trying to get together. Now, individually, we also have our own environment, which is our physical body. And in the course of a lifetime, you know, due to association, one may begin to drink or smoke or eat anything and everything that tastes good, right? But then you learn, if you're fortunate, you learn, well, it's not so good to just eat anything and everything that tastes good. The mother knows that the child just shouldn't eat candy and sweets. Right, you have to eat your vegetables. It's a struggle. Right, have some kind of balance in there. Otherwise, it'll harm the delicate balance of the body, the health of the body. So I remember, I go way back to cigarettes and nicotine, how the tobacco industry fought that for so long. You know, the verdict that the cigarette smoking is so damaging to your health it causes cancer. But they had their own doctors that they paid off. They said, well, it hasn't been proved yet, you know. And people would say, okay, it's not so bad to smoke. But clearly it's a real toxin, you know, that gets in there, nicotine, and not the nicotine so much, but all of the tars and everything. What to speak of alcohol, you know, way back, you know, since time immemorial. There have been people who got into too much alcohol. It damages the body, damages the liver. Everyone knows that. And yet still people drink, people advertise, there's liquor stores in every corner, you know. So there's a constant battle with preserving the balance, the health of your own environment. And the two actually obviously impinge. If the air is polluted all the time, you breathe that in, whether you smoke or not, you'll be damaging the internal environment. So we have this struggle going on. On the one side, there's a motive for unrestricted industrial development. The motive is on the part of, you know, people who own the factories, but also we want the energy that's generated, right? And so there's a positive. But the negative side, the cost, there's a benefit and there's a cost, we see sometimes it's too high. It's too high. That even though we have to have this energy, we can't just keep burning coal and burning oil and burning gas and what the nuclear has its own downside. There has to be another way. We have to find another balance. And the same thing is true for our individual life. Sometimes, we read something and we get enlightened and say, oh, you know, I have to become a vegetarian. And it doesn't have anything to do with Hare Krishna. It's so damaging to the body. You know, this meat that I'm eating. There's so many toxins. Plus, it costs so much. Plus, it's a huge burden on the environment. You know, plus it's horrible for the poor animals. You know, this is just your own consciousness is awakened by reading or associating with someone. And suddenly you think, yeah, I'm being a vegetarian. You know? So you change your internal environment due to what you hear and what you understand, due to your knowledge, you see. And if you become a vegetarian and you do it right, you will feel healthier. You will be. It's proven. There's no question about it. Now, I'd like to move from that. So we move from the environment to the internal environment, our own body, to the more subtle environment of our thoughts and our consciousness. Because we also, in a sense, consume thoughts. In other words, just every day there's a certain amount of stimuli, there's a certain amount of ideas, a certain amount of association that we get that affects our consciousness, right? If we read this book, we'll have these ideas, we'll have these feelings, if we read a different book, that will be a different way. If we see this movie, it'll be this way. If we don't see any movie, it'll be a different way. Music, people, everything affects our consciousness and our thought. So in the same way that there are impurities that build up in the external environment, that after a while, we have to do something about it. We can't just let the carbon dioxide keep going up and up and up and blocking, you know, the rays getting back and heating up the environment. There's going to be grave dangers. So we finally come around to the idea we have to do something about it, right? But people come at different stages. Some, you know, continue to deny it because there are vast forces that have a propaganda machine that tries to put confusion in people's minds. So it's a battle for our consciousness to come to a decision to do something and be really forthright about changing our external environment. And the same thing is true for our diet and our internal environment. At a certain point, we say, okay, you know, I just have to stop smoking. I can't drink. Or on a more refined level, you'd have to give up meat eating, right? And you make a decision to do it. But you're already accustomed to it, so there's maybe a little struggle to give that up. There's an addiction there to one degree or another. But you know it's good for you, and if you're successful, you feel better about it. Now, the same thing is true on the subtle level with our mind and consciousness. And this... As is well known, we are just aware of a small portion of our conscious mind. There's what Freud coined it, the subconscious. There's a vast number of thoughts and ideas and emotions that are buried, that we're not aware of. They may come out in dreams, or they may give us so much anxiety, we don't, just generalized anxiety. You know, I had a panic attack. Why? Because of something that happened in my childhood, you know. And it's still in there. I mean, everyone knows that these impressions last a lifetime. So, or can last a lifetime if they're very severe. By the same token, there can be very positive things that increase or help us to be well-balanced individuals, right? So what I'm getting at here is that we should know, just as we are aware of, if we're conscious beings and a little intelligent, of the external environment and our own physical environment, we should also understand our mental environment. And that the thing that we should strive for, that we should know as an ideal, is what's described here. To have a clear, pure consciousness, undisturbed, by which we can really begin to see the transcendence, begin to see differently. We can see the world differently. Just like someone who's intoxicated. Everyone knows if someone takes too many drinks, they're not themselves, right? They don't react to others the same. They see differently. Different emotions come out. You know, they may fall over, whereas before they were, you know. There's a whole different person there, right? So that's a gross example. But similarly, as we ingest, if you will, different ideas, different thoughts, due to what we choose to expose our senses to in our mind, that transforms our character. That makes our character. You know, what is an education? An education is, after all, you're working with the mind, the intelligence, and the idea is that you study, you get a certain number of ideas, you expose, you train the mind to think in a certain way, and at a certain point, you're kind of a different person. You're more mature, you have certain skills, you have certain understanding of yourself and the world that's different than when before you got that education. Everyone knows that. So, and that's truly the most important of the ecologies, because if someone is educated and sensitive to the stuff that's going on in the environment, then they'll want to do something different than if they just go along day to day or moment to moment doing what feels good. You see what I'm saying? So we bring up this concept which Srila Prabhupada gave us. It's kind of one of these nice little phrases called Shreyas and Prayas. Prayas means, is a Sanskrit word, that means immediate good, immediate pleasure. And Shreyas means ultimate good. And you can see this environmental movement is exactly like that. Prayas means immediate good or, you know, over the next few years, say, rather than for the long-term health of the planet and, you know, society as a whole. So these big capitalists, how do they get to be big capitalists? By stepping on the heads of other people. They kind of have a certain mentality, what we call the mode of passion, you know. Mode of passion is, let me get more. Generally, you know, the theme of mode of passion is more. I want to enjoy more. I want to make more money. You know, I want to have more followers or whatever it is. And you know, in capitalism, means more money. And the more money you get, the more you can make. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. You can invest here, you know, you can do this and make so much money. So in doing that, you have to exploit. They exploit the environment, exploit labor, others, human beings, you know, in order to build up these big industries that we have today. You know, these huge, multi-billion-dollar, multilateral national industries that control so much wealth and things that are going on. So that's good for them and good for the stockholders, but what about everyone else? You know, what about, you know, all of us who have to breathe the air that they're, you know, putting all the pollutants into. And there's also more subtle things that are going on. So, the Shreyas and Prayas. So, for the long-term planet, the Shreya, the ultimate good, is to have control and regulation on this by a higher force, the government. It says, no, you can't just pollute unlimitedly. There are all these regulations for the general people around so that we can have a sustainable environment. That's the whole idea. It has to be sustainable, not just for the next 50 or 100 years. This is what they're thinking, but, you know, for 1,000 years or forever. This is what they hope anyway. So that's Shreyas and Prayas. On our personal level, we see how when a child grows up, the parents know this child has to have an education. Because long term, if they have no education, what's going to happen to their life? The child wants to play all day. What kindergartner really wants to go to kindergarten spontaneously? You know, if the kindergartners would get together, they wouldn't go. None of them would go. They would play all day in the field, right? So, but the society knows, no, these children have to be trained. And ultimately, they'll thank us. You know, they're, oh, yeah, thanks for giving, showing me how to read. So, that's Shreyas and Preyas. For the long-term good, we have certain things that restrict our immediate gratification. And then we see later on, yes, it really was to the ultimate good. So this principle, now let's apply it to our consciousness, to our ultimate destiny. Because after all, according to the Bhagavad Gita, the teachings of the Vedas and the Eastern knowledge in general, we're not these bodies. We're conscious beings. Each of us is sitting in a different body, totally unique, formed by our environment or our nurture in this life, and by our genes, you know, who we took birth from. But ultimately, why did we take birth from a certain family, parents? Why were we born? Why are we sitting here in San Diego rather than in North Dakota somewhere? This is the subtle environment that's under a higher supervision that is called karma. As you act in each life, you're creating certain subtle impressions, and you're creating a universal impression, if you will, that is seen, is understood by a higher intelligence. Just like this whole Mahatattva that we began discussing, this is all a creation of the supreme intelligence belonging to the supreme person. There's not one angstrom unit in creation where there's not an evidence of intelligence. As was brought out recently in one of these Sunday talks, I forget who mentioned, that nothing here is really solid. You know, most of it is a space between the molecules and atoms. But it looks solid. You know? And the air, that's not solid. There's a little more space. But within the atoms and the molecules, there's such arrangement. The balance between the electrons going around and the neutrons and protons in the middle, you know, it's not an accident. I mean, whenever you see organization, this wood, this thing is carved here. Well, there's a straight edge here. But, you know, okay, there's somebody made it straight with an intelligence and with tools and with good eye, right? All around us, we see evidence of that. And if you go outside, you'll see the plants. They're also organized. Or just think of your own body. You know, everything is balanced so nicely. If you get a little bit too much, a little bit too much prasadam, then you know there's an imbalance, and you feel. Right? Everything is balanced. The temperature, it's got to be between 98.6 and 107 or you die. What keeps that regulated? Somebody figured out the thermostat, you know? it's ridiculous to think that, it just came up from an undifferentiated. So, a mass of chemicals. So, that intelligence is also guiding our destiny according to so many things, how we act, what we think, you see, our emotions, everything that we do is part of that mix. So the subtle environment that we have, our consciousness, our intelligence, our mind, you see, our emotions, these, as human beings, we have some control of how to form that, of how to develop that culture for our ultimate good, not for our immediate good. And that culture of how to form the internal environment so that it's balanced and clear and calm and pure, so we can see the truth and reality, is called Krishna consciousness or bhakti yoga. Yoga process in general, is for doing this. You can really think of it all as a process of purification. Just as in the external environment, if the lake gets dirty due to some runoff or something, you want to have a way of trying to purifying it. Because it's better. Things will grow naturally. It'll be better for the environment. Same thing with the air, right? Air filter or stop putting the pollutants in. You want it to be purified because pure is better. It's more natural. It's more pristine. It's more original. So here in this verse that we read, the original state of our consciousness is pure, unruffled, clear and clean. Now, what is it? What are some of the impurities that make us disturbed, that cloud the consciousness so we can't see who we really are? What to speak of? The supreme, intelligent being. The general principle is, going back to Shreyas and Preyas, when we think of our immediate gratification, we have these senses, right? And the senses have objects that some of them are pleasing, some of them are displeasing, but there's a certain set of sense objects as human beings that are pleasing, right? To have a little tablespoon of honey, you know, is generally pleasing for everybody, right? That's kind of, you know, sweet. But if it's some kind of alkali or something, you wouldn't touch it. A little different in the chemistry, you know, and it becomes unpalatable. So the senses all have, there's, you know, we want to see beauty. We don't want to see ugliness, you know. We want to hear wonderful sounds, you know. If someone is singing out of key or someone is playing out of key, you know, that's discordant. It kind of almost hurts sometimes. We have kirtans like that sometimes, but that's another thing. In any musical presentation, kirtan is auspicious. But we know how it's more attractive if there's a harmony, a concert, right? Balance. So the same thing is there for the thoughts that we allow to come into our mind. And in bhakti yoga process, the purification chiefly is by means of chanting the name of Krishna, chanting the name of the Supreme Lord. This mantra, this maha mantra, it is said, Chaito Darpana Marjanam. This is spoken by Lord Chaitanya, Mahaprabhu, who's pictured behind me, dancing with Nityananda, whose appearance day we just celebrated. So what does this Chaito Darpana Marjanam mean? Marjanam means to cleanse, and Darpana is a mirror. So our consciousness, our mind, is like a mirror in one sense. We can see ourselves in the pure when the mirror is cleansed. But when it's dusty and dirty, we can't. We have a distorted vision of ourself. And we can't see at all the Supreme who's also within us. So we need that cleansing process. And when we focus on the name, the idea is to hear. It's not such an easy thing, you know, to hear with one pointed attention. We're ready to hear with one pointed attention when we're praised, isn't it? We become very attentive. If our glories are being chanted, Victor, you're such a wonderful dancer. See, immediately he's paying attention. But you know, but if someone else is being praised, or something is, you know, then the mind tends to wander to something more pleasurable that we think about. So, but yoga means to focus the mind. That's the first thing: control the senses and focus the mind on the object of meditation. Krishna talks about that in the sixth chapter. Now, the wonderful thing about Krishna consciousness is that in the most deepest and profound sense, we as spirit souls are most attracted to Krishna. The very word Krishna, the name Krishna, means all attractive. In every sense, everything I mentioned, what's attractive? Well, beauty is attractive, nice taste, nice fragrance, nice personality. You know, we're attracted to people who have these qualities. And we're also attracted mostly to people who like us, right? If someone likes you, then that's a very great attraction, you know. And so if someone has all those qualities, you can imagine. You know, they're very beautiful, suave, young, handsome, very imaginative, you know, adventurous. All of these qualities, and they like you. They love you. Well, would you be attracted or not? That's Krishna. And we sometimes forget that, you know, God is a person just as we are in many ways. But what's so special is that he can have unlimited intimate relationships with all of us. We can't. We can only, you know, how many people can we really relate to personally? 10, 12, 20? You know, Facebook says, I have 1,000 friends. But do you really have 1,000 friends? I friended you, you know. What do those people know about you? What do you know about them? So, but Krishna really can have 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000, 1,000,000,000,000 friends. And each friend can feel the personal love of Krishna and affection of Krishna. But we have to purify our consciousness to be able to perceive that. And the purifying process, as I mentioned, begins with the chanting, but it doesn't end with the chanting. The chanting leads, or is the basis of, a whole culture that involves all the senses and the mind and the intelligence, everything we have. The senses. The Vedic culture recognizes active senses, such as the voice. We can do so many things with the voice. You know, we can insult someone. We can start a movement. Just like Hitler His great power was his voice, his ability to speak. The radio had just become popular. He was able to mesmerize the whole German population into believing his crazy philosophy and going to war and creating havoc for the whole world just by the voice. You see how powerful the voice is. So what the voice used for chanting the holy name and speaking these words, just like I had you chant, those of you, most of us could do it, it's word by word, is Sanskrit, very powerful language. And these words are all of the transcendence. They're describing from the, you know, this is Kapila Deva, an expansion of Krishna, how the creation came to be. So when we glorify the Lord with our voice, when we hear this philosophy and the holy name with our ears, when we taste wonderful vegetarian foodstuff that have been offered with love to Krishna, prepared with love, when we smell the fragrance of the flowers and the incense offered to the Lord, you see? When we see the beautiful paintings and, of course, the deity form on the altar, all the senses, yeah, all the senses can be engaged. And when we use our intelligence to study and think about the philosophy and try to take up the process, you know, and see how we can also participate in the chanting. These are all of our faculties, the mind, the intelligence, the senses. And when we control our environment, you know. And when you walk into your home, everyone knows a home is the reflection of your personality, right? So it also affects your personality. You walk into your home and you got posters of this band and that band, and you turn on the forgive me, I'm completely dated. Grunge music is still out around? What is that, 12, 15 years out of date? But, you know, the same idea. Hip-hop is still going on. That will immediately affect your consciousness. But if you turn on Beethoven, that's a different mode, you know? Or Srila Prabhupada chanting. You see, so everything affects. We can decide our environment. We can decide what to do with our time. So as to change our internal environment, meaning our consciousness. And then we start to feel the benefits, just like someone who becomes a vegetarian, you know, before long, you start to feel the benefits. Lose some weight, feel a little clearer, lighter, more energy, healthier. And over time, you feel a lot of benefits. Wow, I'm glad I didn't develop this disease, that disease, and this disease, you know, whereas other people my age, they did develop it because I had a balanced vegetarian diet. So the idea is that this Krishna consciousness is long-term. Ultimately, it's for eternity. And we have the power as human beings, intelligent human beings, especially those who are here who are interested, to transform that internal environment. And it needs transforming. We have so many thoughts, so many ideas, so many emotions that have gone deep and that affect our present state of consciousness, even though we may not know it. But if we culture, the more that we can understand this philosophy through the books of Srila Prabhupada, also, little plug, we have lectures, we have a nice little discussion, three nights a week, 7:15, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, right here in the temple. You're welcome to come. On the Bhagavad Gita, then we have a nice kirtan, see the deities in their nice night outfits, and a little prasadam. Three nights a week, Thursday, same time, right there in the house next door. It's transformed into the Krishna Lounge, and more chanting, free prasadam, and more discussion. Friday night, you're welcome to join us. We celebrate the name of the Lord right on the street, downtown, in the gas lamp. And Saturday, of course, we have more programs. Sunday, you're here. So every night, what to speak of the morning, without fail, if you're serious, really serious, 4:30 in the morning. Little, maybe can't make it 4:30, come at 7:15. And these programs are going on every day. Every single day, we have these wonderful programs by which you can take part in this process of devotional service. And it extends. Everything starts with the consciousness. Everything. How you think, how you act, how you feel, what your environment is going to be, both locally in your home and externally in the larger environment. It all starts with the consciousness. And when that consciousness is purified and clear and calm, then there's no question of creating, you know, horrible works meant to, you know, that will create great environmental disasters. That all comes from what we call the asuric mentality. More. You know, Ishroham Humbo Gisido Humbalaman Suki. This is the mantra of the Asuras, the demonic. I am the master. I am the enjoyer. I am perfect, powerful, and happy. You know, I'll kill this enemy. I'll do this. I'll amass a fortune. Nothing like that. Live simply, purely, and you cultivate the internal purity, and you become naturally happy. Krishna describes, he says, prasade. Prasad has different meanings. Of course, we know prasadam as transcendental food, vegetarian food that we will partake of soon. But prasad in general means the grace of the higher power. And that grace comes in many ways. And here he says, prasade savadukana. When you attain this steady consciousness, Krishna describes in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, savadukanam hanir. All your unhappiness will be gone. You don't have to take a pill. You don't have to do this or try to cover it with some drug or alcohol. No. Just practice Krishna consciousness. Get this calm consciousness. Savadukanam hanir asya upajayate. Prasanna chetaso. Prasanna is exactly this. Very clear consciousness and very naturally joyful. By nature, the soul is full of ananda. Ananda means spiritual bliss. By nature. So are we all now full of spiritual bliss? I'm not yet. Maybe sometimes I see a little bit of it. But that means we all have to have work to do. Try to get back to our natural state. But prasanna chetaso buddhi paryavatishtate, when consciousness becomes fixed, you see. So this is possible, as Srila Prabhupada says in the previous verse, as Krishna says, by practicing the regulative principles of freedom. Very nice. Now, the big companies, get rid of the regulations. No regulations, Let us, expand unlimitedly, and the wealth will trickle down. They don't use that term, but that's what the idea is. But no, we need regulations. We need to regulate ourselves personally and as a society. Because without regulation, there's just unlimited expansion of greed and people who want to attain immediate gratification. And that hurts all of us. So with these regulative principles of freedom, now it almost seems like what they call an oxymoron. Oxymoron means that it's a self-contradictory term. But it's not. By becoming regulated and following the discipline of bhakti yoga, you become free from the thrall or control of what we call maya shakti, the illusory energy. Just like a drug addict becomes free by regulation from the control of the drug, right? And once you're free, you've given up the cigarettes or harder stuff, whatever, you say, oh, what a relief, it's a whole new life, you see? It's a whole new state of consciousness. So that similarly, once we become free, as we proceed to become free, before we even become completely free, of so many things that are controlling us and bringing us down and covering original consciousness, back to the theme of a need for purification, there's a whole new appreciation for the world, for ourselves, for our loved ones, for our family. Everything becomes auspicious. So this is what Krishna consciousness is about. And once again, just to sum up, we can think of our life as an effort to purify. Everyone who's, a normal human being likes to clean their house every so often, or apartment, right? Because, it's disturbing to the mind if it gets dirty, So that works on an environmental level, on a personal level, on an internal environment of your, home and physical, and also on the level of consciousness, that we should strive to purify as much as possible to come back to that original, pristine, clear, calm, blissful state of Krishna consciousness. Thank you very much. If there are any questions or comments, we can entertain them at this time. Radha Dasi.
I just wanted to just add, thank you for the talk. That was very,
Hare Krishna.
Very sweet.
Close to
I just wanted to add that if your work or the distance you have to travel, if there's any reason why you can't come to the temple every day, we can also teach you how to put an altar in your home and make your home into a temple so that you can still practice this process every day.
Yes, and what is the name of it? What is it called?
Well, we have the Shiksha program. There's a table outside. My husband will be able to give you more information.
Shiksha. Shiksha means instruction. And so Radhadasini and her good husband, Yudhishthira Prabhu, they've started a very nice program because of course, we of us who live in the temple or near the temple full time, we're fortunate. We can take full advantage. But there's so many of you who you have jobs. You may live far from the temple, but that doesn't mean anything. You make your home into a temple, or you just take as much of it as you can. And it's so potent, this process, the chanting and so many other things, that you'll immediately be able to feel the benefit. There's no bar. Anyone can take up the process and make good progress in a quick amount of time. There was another hand somewhere? Yes, Prabhu.
Bible says, God gave man the dominion over things on the land, in the air, and the water. That almost fits the definition of what you said, Asuri. Is there a good interpretation of that?
Yes. I don't think that statement in itself is a suric. Just like parents have dominion, control over their children. But that doesn't mean that they slaughter them and eat them. They use this for an argument for how we can, slaughter animals and kill them. Well, we have dominion, therefore we can. The idea is that the powerful are meant to protect the weak, not to exploit them. It's all a question, again, of consciousness. So yes, of course, as human beings, we have dominion over the environment. But we're meant to treat that environment with respect. Just as even the plants, they're very valuable. They're also living entities. We as devotees, these plants out here in our little patio area, we try to engage them in Krishna consciousness. How? Well, there's so many flowers there, They can be picked and offered to Krishna. And even though that living entity and that plant is, has a lower consciousness, that offering is to their benefit. But on a wider level, if you live a simple life, a life based on that dials down your consumption of things that are completely unnecessary. The whole effort of the capitalist system, if you will, or the system that we have, is to make you think you need so many things that you don't need, right? Even they sell you, like I have this little iPod that I'm recording on now, right? So I didn't pay for it; it was given to me. But still, there's so many millions of these sold. So that was the fourth generation. So they had the second generation. That was the first thing. And it was perfectly fine. Then they changed the software so the second generation won't work anymore with it. So I have to get the third generation. Luckily, someone gave it to me. Okay, now I'll dial it up. Okay. And then they changed it again. Now the fourth generation. It has a one-pixel camera. What can you do with that, Okay, the fifth generation has a five-pixel camera. Okay, let me throw this away so I'll get it. Planned obsolescence. So, but what do we really need to be happy? The natural environment of the out in the country, rural environment. This is original. This is Krishna's original environment in Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan. It's full of flowers and fruits in the seasons. The cows are happy; they're not being slaughtered. They're giving milk abundance. There's no violence. The violence. We pull a covering on our consciousness when we think that we can exploit living beings who are less intelligent than us, who are, That means, that we don't understand that they have feelings, that they have consciousness. So dominion, of course the question is, how do you translate a word? Dominion here means you're a steward. We're stewards, just like you're on a Gidanagari farm. There's so many cows there. So certainly the human beings have dominion over the cows, but they don't torture them, they don't slaughter them, they don't... And the cows are happy to do what they do best, which is to give the milk, And in this way, there's a symbiosis that everyone benefits. So that's the positive interpretation of that. Dominion doesn't mean exploitation for gross sense gratification. That's my understanding of that. Thank you very much. We'll now have a little more kirtan, and then a wonderful vegetarian feast offered to Krishna. All glories to Shri Krishna.